Hi there, Billy Hindle here, the voice of Alice Dyer in the Magnus Protocol. As part of the Magnus Archive's 10th anniversary, Rusty Quill is hosting a special Magnus Live show at the upcoming Crossed Wires Podcast Festival in Sheffield. Join co-creators Jonathan Sims and Alexander J. Newell on the 5th of July for a new iteration of our live show, Statement Begins, where you can hear fan-favourite statements such as Anglerfish, Red Live, and gain exclusive insights into the creation and history of the show straight from the creators themselves. You can buy your tickets now, including limited numbers of meet and greet tickets, from crossedwires.live or the link in the description of this episode.
Hi everyone, it's Kareem, the voice of Simon Fairchild from the Magnus Archives. Today I'm here to advertise Beck's End, an upcoming new audio drama that will be launching on the RQ network. Beck's End is a folk horror audio drama about isolation, belief, radicalization, and poses the question if redemption is possible. When floodwaters swallow an idyllic English Lake District village, a stranded journalist finds herself trapped in a rising tide of fear. Cut off from the outside world, she begins to uncover horrors both human and biblical, lurking beneath the surface. If this intrigues you, you can support the creation of Beck's End on Kickstarter until the 17th of July. For more information on the show and to pledge your support, visit becksend.com. That's becksend.com. And you might recognize a voice here or there. Have fun and enjoy the episode.
I'd just like to take a moment to thank some of our patrons. Catherine Muchika, Kitty Hanan, Paige Steele, Alexander C. Barr, Jean Ferguson, Sarah Beacon, Kate Carter, Josh H., Neil Harvey, H.P. Starcraft, Bailey Anderson, Bob Wallace, Anne, Jane Belinskaya, Alexander Vane, Ben Bloomquist, Liam McLaughlin, Nathan Lake Starr, Brenna DeLoon. Thank you all. We really appreciate your support. If you'd like to join them, go to www.patreon.com/rustyquill and take a look at our rewards.
Rusty Quill presents The Magnus Archives. Episode 141, Doomed Voyage.
Better.
Not really.
You were the one that suggested we go by boat.
Didn't think I... Oh. I haven't really done proper boats before.
Hold on. Excuse me.
Yeah?
Do you know when we're scheduled to arrive?
Captain reckons 2 days.
Thank you. He says another 2 days.
Yeah, I heard. Thanks. What?
Tape recorder.
Get ready. Any idea what's coming?
No, I don't think that's it.
It's not recording for nothing.
No, I think... Excuse me?
Yeah.
You?
John?
You used to work for Salesa.
Well, who did? I don't know what you're talking about.
Mikhail Salesa. You used to work on his ship.
I don't know you.
But I know you.
John.
Floyd Matharu served on the Dorian from 2011 to 2014 with Salesa.
John, I'm not sure about this.
I am. Tell me what happened.
What is this?
Whenever you're ready.
All right. Sure. He was a good boss, you know. Worked with him for 3 years and treated us well. He never lied to us about the sort of thing he was into. He didn't exactly volunteer specifics, But we all knew what we were doing was illegal. And we trusted him because he knew what he was doing. It was a weird ship to be on, though not just because everyone was always gossiping about whatever the latest haunted cargo was. A lot of it was because we had a captain, a man named Gaultier, but he reported to Salesa. Normally, if the captain's working for someone, they're going to be on the ship all the time. They'll just be organizing things, so there's no worries about who's in charge. You just obey the captain. The Salesa always traveled with us, keeping an eye on whatever he was moving that day. He felt like he was a part of the crew, even though he didn't actually have a job to do. Always felt a bit uncomfortable when the captain was giving orders and he was there. I could sometimes feel Captain Gaultier looking to him for support or confirmation, and that always slightly undermined our confidence in him. It wasn't a problem, not really, and Salesa never threw his weight around, never contradicted the captain in front of us or anything. It was a weird dynamic. Where the others talked about it, he'd been at this for a long time, decades at least, and when I sailed with him, it was clear he knew exactly what he was doing. He was the only one ever allowed in the cargo bay during a voyage. I only saw one person trying to break that rule. Jesus, a nasty piece of work we picked up in Colombia, and who clearly thought he smelled an opening. Salesa was a big guy, you know, but he never really made anything of it. He always used to say he needed a crew to follow him out of trust, not fear. But he didn't have a problem using his size against Jesus when he found him. He threw the little rat overboard without a second's hesitation, and there was nobody on that ship unhappy he did it. They all seen what could happen when someone else got in the cargo bay. My last voyage with him was the one that killed him, 7 years ago. I still have nightmares sometimes, try to escape it. But some things follow you no matter where you go. A smarter person might have stayed off the water, but this job, it's all I've ever really known. So here we are. It was an odd time, I remember. I don't know exactly what was different, but the whole mood of the ship was off. Kind of sour, somehow. I think it must have been Salesa. Everything always kind of reflected him. You know people like that? When he was happy, satisfied, everything seemed to run smooth. When he was angry, everyone would be on edge, irritable. But right then, he was tired. Everyone could tell. The man had been doing this job non-stop as long as any of us could remember. And he was clearly starting to feel it. Once found him poring over an old photo album. The ship was there in the pictures, but a different captain, different crew. I asked him who they were, and he just looked at me, eyes sunken like he hadn't slept. And for a second, I felt like he was seeing someone else, not me. But then he just shrugged. "Dead now," he said. "Doesn't really matter." That was about a month before Gantula died. It should have been a nice, simple job. I helped load the box under Salesa's supervision, and it was barely a few meters across. Dantes told me it was a carpet that he bought from an old Burmese beggar woman who fed lost children to a crocodile head. But I never paid any attention. He liked to make up wild stories about whatever it was that Salesa had bought. It was light enough, though. So I thought he might have been right about it being a rug. I don't know what went wrong. He was always so careful. I didn't even usually think about the cargo during the trip itself. But this time, I didn't have much choice. Gantulga and I were both off duty that night, played some cards, I lost some money, and we both headed to our bunks. Nothing unusual. Nothing worth being burned into my mind, except that 3 hours later, I was woken up by the sound of Gantula screaming his lungs out. I ran over to him, trying to see what was going on. He was being attacked, that much was clear, but there wasn't anyone there. The thing that was grabbing him, trying to reach down his throat and pull him apart, was a pattern. Diamonds and swirls and colours that seemed to imprint itself upon his skin even as it pushed itself messily into his nose and mouth. What it was made of, I couldn't say. The way it moved and shifted made my head throb with pain. I screamed, staggered back and fell, hitting my head on the table. I can't have been out for more than a few seconds, but when I opened my eyes, he was there, dragging the thrashing body of Kantoga through the door and up onto the deck. I followed slowly and steadily, but got there just in time to see Salazar throw both him and what looked like a blank rug over the side and into the ocean. Then he collapsed against the railing, a look of intense exhaustion passing over his face, and I left him there. He was drunk for the next 2 days, and we kept sailing on towards Cape Town. We no longer had anything to deliver there, but no one was really sure what else to do. Whenever there had been similar disasters before, Salazar was quick to make a new plan, let Captain Gaultier know what the next steps were. It was one of the reasons the crew trusted him so much. He just always seemed to know what we needed to do next. This time, though, felt different. He was distant, quiet. His words, when he spoke to you at all, were blurred with alcohol and regret. Nobody knew what the plan was, so we just kept going. When we hit port, he disappeared for a while. Nobody was sure where. And even when he showed back up, he was spending his time on the phone. We all assumed he was trying to arrange the next job, but he had this wild energy I'd never seen in him before, and it scared me. Whatever he was planning, it wasn't going to be like the others. We were sure about that. Finally, he called us all together. The captain's there, but he doesn't look happy. Salazar starts talking, says he's been doing this for too long, he's getting slow, says he's retiring. So far, so sad, but not unexpected at that point. Then, he says he wants to send us off with a proper payday, that there's one last job he wants us to do. Very dangerous, very illegal. There are murmurs, questions, some angry, some confused. Salazar says anyone who doesn't want to be a part of it, they can stay in port with a decent severance and find another job. If you take him up on that and the rest of us decide to stay, so the captain's clearly not happy. This is costing him experienced crew. Still, he doesn't speak up. I can see in his eyes the greed's got him like it's got the rest of us. It's not like we were underpaid on the Dorian, but there were rumours about how much money Salazar was making out of all this. When someone like that says there's going to be a big payout, you listen. He was really cagey on the details, clearly being careful about exactly who he was telling exactly what. All I knew is that we were on our way to the Maldives, to a tiny island about 100 kilometres south of Malé. No one would tell me the name of the island, but in that area of the world, any islands that small are usually private, though I had no idea who the owner might have been. Once there, Salazar and the four crew members he trusted most were going to take the small boat over the island. We were to wait and prepare to depart as quickly as possible as soon as they returned. He didn't say exactly what he was expecting to happen on the island, but it wasn't hard to guess that whatever he was retrieving, it wasn't something he was purchasing legally. He made it clear we shouldn't stop if we were followed or challenged by the authorities, and we should all be prepared to defend the ship should anyone attempt to board or stop us. The 3 hours I stood on the deck after they left on the little boat may well have been the longest of my life. It was night, of course, and we had no lights showing, nothing that would give us away. The island was completely dark as well, and if it hadn't been for the bright moon shining down on the dense trees and sandy beach, I might not have been able to see it at all. The sound of the boat's engine died quickly, and I was left standing there, surrounded by silence, waiting for something to happen, full of fear over what it was I had agreed to be a part of. I longed to have a drink, to close my eyes and rest for only a second, but every nerve in my body was on alert. When they returned, only two of the four crew members Salesa had taken were still with him. Questions as to what happened were met with dark looks and shaken heads. I felt the rumble of the ship beneath me almost immediately, and only got the briefest of glances at exactly what it was we were all risking our lives for. I've gone over that memory so many times, trying to think what I might have missed. But even now, whenever I think of it, it just looked like an old camera with a broken lens. And then Salesa closed and locked the metal box and carried it down into the hold as we started to sail away. As he did so, I saw a flash out of the corner of my eye. I was on watch, so I hurried to the stern to see what was happening. There was a storm over the island. I don't know where it came from. It can't have been more than a minute since I last looked at it, and the skies were completely clear. But now it was covered in lightning. The clouds above it were dark and angry. The forked flashes came quickly, less than a second between them. And as the thunder started to hit my ears, I could see the trees of the island beginning to catch fire and burn. But there was something else. In the light of the flashing storm, I could clearly see the waters around the island, and there was something there. A huge shape, a shadow surrounding it on all sides, getting darker, getting closer, coming in from deep, deep below the surface. It must have been huge, so large that the edge of it almost touched the ship. And had we been a few minutes slower, I have no doubt whatever awful thing emerged that night, it would have taken us as well. Something began to break the surface as I realized the deep rumble was no longer the thunder. And I closed my eyes and felt the deck, gripping the rail with all my might as a wave hit us from behind, propelling us away from it. When it had finally subsided, and I could bring myself to look back, the island was gone, and ocean was still. Our journey back was a long one, but Salesa was in far better mood than I had ever seen him. His step was light, his smile was easy, and deep circles under his eyes seemed to be gone. He didn't talk about what had happened on the island, not of Christopher or Adrias, the two who had not returned. When we finally arrived in Southampton, he insisted on throwing a ridiculous party to celebrate our good fortune. The drinks flowed freely, and he walked around and shook each of us by the hand, telling us how much he would miss us in retirement, and hiding his insincerity well. I do not believe there was a sober person on the Dorian when the night was over, and we slept easily. Well, the others slept easily, but they had not seen what I had seen. I didn't hear the explosion myself. Dantas told me about it, as it had apparently woken him up and a few others of the crew. A big explosion, they said, further into the port. We staggered onto the deck, and sure enough, smoke could be seen a little way off, its source hidden behind a wall of shipping containers. There was no reason at that point to suspect it had anything to do with us, but I think somehow we all knew what it meant, that something had gone terribly wrong. Nobody could find Salesa or the captain, who were still stood there, arguing amongst ourselves about what to do when Captain Gaultier made his dramatic reappearance. His clothes were torn, and his hair matted with blood. Before any of us could speak, he commanded us to leave, to take up anchor and get out of there. We did as we were ordered, and left immediately. Some tried to ask the captain about Salesa, but he just shook his head. He wasn't making much sense. We managed to gather the two of them had left early to deliver the artifact, But something had gone wrong. There had been an argument. They had been betrayed. Selesa was dead. The captain died soon after. The shrapnel trapped in his skull finally getting the better of him. Who they'd been meeting, how exactly they had been betrayed, were secrets he took with him to the grave. The crew fragmented after that. I think a few of them managed to retain ownership of the Dorian, but they weren't people I was close to. So I jumped ship the next chance I got. And I have tried ever since to leave those memories behind me.
Thank you.
What?
You can go.
I don't...
Thank you, Floyd. You've been very helpful. It's all right, Floyd. You just need a break.
Yeah. Sure.
What the hell was that?
He had information about Selesa. I thought it would help.
Is that why you were so keen on this ship?
I wasn't sure. Just had a hunch there was something here.
And what? You thought the best way to find it was by slurping it out of his brain?
He didn't exactly seem inclined to volunteer the information. Besides, you said I needed to be ready for Nialasund. Full power, I believe were your words. The statement helped.
And now he's going to see you in his dreams as he relives that for the rest of his life. Because a tape recorder told you to do it.
Yes, Basira, he is. And I am sorry about that. But we needed it. Anyway, you're the one who wants to be like Gertrude. You think she'd give a damn about a few bad dreams?
No.
No. She got the job done and didn't care about the cost.
But I thought you did.
I had to know, Sarah.
It wasn't right.
You could have stopped me. But you wanted to know as well, didn't you? Get some rest. 2 days yet.
The Magnus Archives is a podcast distributed by Rusty Quill and licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 4.0 International License. Today's episode was written by Jonathan Sims and directed by Alexander J. Newell. To subscribe, view associated material, or join our Patreon, visit rustyquill.com. Rate and review us online, tweet us at @TheRustyQuill, visit us on Facebook or email us at mail@rustyquill.com. Join our communities on the forum via the website or on Reddit at r/TheMagnusArchives. Thanks for listening.
Hi everyone, it's Kareem, the voice of Simon Fairchild from the Magnus Archives. Today, I'm here to advertise Beck's End, an upcoming new audio drama that will be launching on the RQ network. Beck's End is a folk horror audio drama about isolation, belief, radicalization, and poses the question if redemption is possible. When floodwaters swallow an idyllic English Lake District village, a stranded journalist finds herself trapped in a rising tide of fear. Cut off from the outside world, she begins to uncover horrors both human and biblical, lurking beneath the surface. If this intrigues you, you can support the creation of Beck's End on Kickstarter until the 17th of July. For more information on the show and to pledge your support, visit becksend.com. That's becksend.com. And you might recognize a voice here or there. Have fun and enjoy the episode.
Hi, Alex here, founder and CEO of Rusty Quill Limited. In case you haven't heard, there is now a Magnus Archives novel. The Library of Jürgen Leitner is set in the world of the Magnus Archives and written by Nebula Award-winning author Premi Mohammed with our very own Jonathan Sims. The story follows Hugh, a university dropout desperate to find somewhere to belong and his new job at an esoteric library. The books he must investigate for the enigmatic Jürgen Leitner are not normal. because the library is not a vault, sealed and silent, but a hive, alive, buzzing, and ready to sting. The Library of Jürgen Leitner releases October 27th, 2026, but you can pre-order it right now in the US and UK from your local bookshop or by using the link in the episode description. If you live outside of the UK or US, you may be able to make an international order for this first publication, but it depends on individual retailers' shipping policies.